William Patterson, as the delegate of a small state, feared the ease with which a large state's delegates could bully and shove their way to dominance in any new modeled Congress. That was precisely what he saw happening in the Randolph Plan. And so he prepared his attack on the Randolph Plan with great care. The day following the report of the Committee of the Whole on the Randolph Plan, Patterson finished what he regarded as a purely federal alternative plan, which he said several of the deputations wished to be substituted in place of that proposed by Mr. Randolph. And he did mean several. Patterson had been industriously circulating among the other small state delegations, cementing alliances and lining up individuals to speak to any objections from the Madison-Randolph quarter. Patterson's plan, James Madison irritably jotted, had been concerted among the deputations or members thereof from Connecticut, New York, New Jersey, Delaware, and the confidence with which they entered the assembly room that day began now to produce serious anxiety for the result of the convention. John Dickinson, in passing, remarked to Madison in a patronizing, "I told you so" tone, that the Virginians had wanted too much, too fast, in creating a single, powerful national government. "Now," said Dickinson, "now you see the consequence of pushing things too far. It may well be that the delegations would embrace a bicameral national legislature, but the representation in both houses had to be as it was in the Confederation Congress. Each state, one vote. Some of the members from the small states wish for two branches in the general legislature," Dickinson added, "and are friends to a good national government, but we would sooner submit to a foreign power than submit to be deprived of an equality of suffrage in both branches of the legislature, and thereby be thrown under the domination of the large states." Of course, to Madison, this was no improvement whatsoever on the Articles of Confederation. Single states would continue to carry an outsized weight in any new Congress, and the results would always be the same: paralysis at the national level, reckless abandon at the state level. And after enough recklessness, the whole Union would come tumbling down. The great powers on their borders would hungrily return America to colonial status, and the great national experiment in natural rights, liberty, and self-government would be over. But not even Madison dared to deny how much that equality of suffrage, that equal representation of states in the new government, was a fetish for the small states. Just how alluring that fetish would be became apparent as Patterson took the floor at the beginning of the June 15th session. He had 9 resolutions to submit, which would make up what soon enough would be called the New Jersey Plan. First, in the spirit of reasonableness, Patterson allowed that the Articles of Confederation ought to be so revised, corrected, and enlarged as to render the federal Constitution adequate to the exigencies of the government and the preservation of the Union. He was willing to concede, if people really wanted it, a bicameral national legislature, although what he wanted really was a single unicameral national Congress. But this Congress should be authorized to pass acts for raising a revenue, by levying a duty or duties on all goods or merchandises of foreign growth or manufacture imported into any part of the United States. And the Congress should be able to pass acts for the regulation of trade and commerce as well with foreign nations as with each other, provided, and here was the sting, that all punishments, fines, forfeitures, and penalties to be incurred for contravening such acts, rules, and regulations shall be adjudged by the common law judiciaries of the state in which any offense shall have been committed or perpetrated. That, as Madison and Patterson both well knew, meant the delivery of a veto power over the operation of trade and commerce to state courts. That was what had made Rhode Island infamous and made the borrowing of foreign capital for development nearly impossible. Under the veneer of reasonableness, Patterson was already ensuring more of the status quo. Patterson next turned to the kind of taxation which would be necessary to support a new national government. Once again, the veneer of reasonableness. Instead of the rule for making requisitions mentioned in the Articles of Confederation, Patterson said, Congress should levy taxes on the states in proportion to the whole number of white and other free citizens and inhabitants of every age, sex, and condition, including those bound to servitude for a term of years, and 3/5 of all other persons not comprehended in the foregoing description. Here was a scheme for proportionate representation even Madison could applaud. Except that it wasn't about representation, it was about taxation. Large states, like Virginia, with 750,000 people, would pay more of the share of the national budget than small states, like New Jersey, with 180,000. In fact, it would have to pay more than 3 times as much, but it would not get more than the same single vote in Congress that New Jersey enjoyed in determining how or when or where that money should be spent. Fourth, Patterson conceded that it would be a good idea to elect a federal executive with what he called general authority to execute the federal acts, to appoint all federal officers not otherwise provided for, and to direct all military operations. But what Patterson seemed to yield with one hand in the Virginians' direction, he promptly took back with the other. He left unstated whether this executive should be one person or a committee. And he wanted it clear that none of the persons composing the federal executive shall on any occasion take command of any troops so as personally to conduct any enterprise as general or in any other capacity. This may have been a wagged finger in the direction of George Washington, or at least an effort to prevent Randolph and Madison from sweetening the notion of a federal executive by implying that the great Washington would be the ideal man to fill the post. Well, Washington was a soldier, plain and simple. A federal executive which debarred its occupants from serving in any practical military capacity would turn Washington's greatest asset into a useless liability. But even more than keeping military authority out of the hands of the executive, Patterson also wanted this executive to be removable by Congress on application by a majority of the executives of the several states. Whoever or whatever the executive was, it would remain firmly subordinate, not just to Congress, but to the states. Finally, Patterson was willing to see a federal judiciary established to consist of a supreme tribunal, the judges of which would be appointed by the executive, but its powers would be severely limited to strictly federal matters. It shall have authority, Patterson said, on all impeachments of federal officers, in all cases touching the rights of ambassadors, in all cases of piracies and felonies on the high seas, or over the collection of the federal revenue, but nothing was said about the federal judiciary having any restraining power on the actions of the states. So there it was, the New Jersey plan, creating the semblance of a new national government, but granting it hardly any new powers, and certainly none which might seriously threaten the free hand of each state to do what it wanted. The plan was not entirely Patterson's work. Luther Martin of Maryland, who had only arrived in Philadelphia on June 9th, was anxious to keep a new national government from having the power to restrain state issues of paper money, and he became Patterson's most important ally. At the separation from the British Empire, Martin declared on June 20th, the people of America preferred the establishment of themselves into 13 separate sovereignties instead of incorporating themselves into one. They are afraid, Martin continued, of granting powers unnecessarily, lest they should defeat the original end of the Union, lest the powers should prove dangerous to the sovereignties of the particular states which the Union was meant to support, and expose the lesser to being swallowed up by the larger. John Lansing of New York, likewise, complained that the plan of Mr. Randolph absorbs all power except what may be exercised in the little local matters of the states, which are not objects worthy of the supreme cognizance. But the bluntest summary of the New Jersey plan's intentions came from the corpulent and impetuous Gunning Bedford of Delaware. Randolph and the Virginians, said Bedford, insist that although the powers of the general government will be increased, yet it will be for the good of the whole. But, said Bedford, I do not, gentlemen, trust you. If you possess the power, he said, the abuse of it could not be checked. And what then would prevent you from exercising it to our destruction? You will annihilate your federal government, and ruin must stare you in the face. Let us then do what is in our power, amend and enlarge the Confederation, but not alter the federal system. The people expect this and no more. Nothing, wrote Madison later that year, created more embarrassment and a greater alarm for the issue of the convention than Patterson's rival plan. The little states insisted on retaining their equality, while the large states urged that as the new government was to be drawn from the people immediately and was to operate directly on them, it was necessary that the representation should be in proportion to their size. Even Washington verged on despair at the revolt of the small states. Everybody wishes, everybody expects something from the convention, Washington wrote privately to David Stewart, a physician in Alexandria who had married the widow of Washington's stepson, Jackie Custis. But Washington continued, the local views of each state and separate interests by which they are too much governed will not yield to a more enlarged scale of politics. And it wasn't just short-sightedness which prevented the adoption of the Virginia Plan. It was downright bad faith, said Washington. Demagogues, wrote Washington bitterly, men who are unwilling to lose any of their state consequence and interested characters in each will oppose any general government. The situation was not helped by the confused response of the delegates who rose to defend the Virginia Plan. James Wilson, the nearsighted Pennsylvania legal scholar whose house had been converted into Fort Wilson to defend himself and Robert Morris against the street mob in 1779, Wilson offered a patient, logical contrast of Randolph's and Patterson's plans. Wilson had none of the mistrust Gunning Bedford was possessed with. Where do the people look at present for relief from the evils of which they complain? Is it from an internal reform of their governments? No, sir. It is from the national councils that relief is expected. And what exactly lies behind the assumption that state governments were virtuous and national governments dangerous? The smallest bodies in Great Britain, said Wilson, are notoriously the most corrupt, and largely because corruption is easier to pull off in small rather than large bodies of men. The same principle applied to the kind of unicameral legislature that Patterson was advocating for a new Congress. If the legislative authority be not restrained, there can be neither liberty nor stability, something Wilson knew all about from the experience of Pennsylvania. It can only be restrained by dividing it within itself into distinct and independent branches. In a single house, there is no check but the inadequate one of the virtue and good sense of those who compose it. On the other hand, the same principle worked in reverse when it came to an executive. In order to control the legislative authority, you must divide it. But in order to control the executive, you must unite it. Three will contend among themselves till one becomes the master of his colleagues. But when Alexander Hamilton followed Wilson on June 18th, he nearly threw the game away entirely. Hamilton, of course, had no use for Patterson's New Jersey plan. The problem was that he seemed to have little more use for Randolph's. The Virginia plan, said Hamilton, was but pork still with a little change of the sauce. He was fully convinced that no amendment of the Confederation, leaving the states in possession of their sovereignty, could possibly answer the purpose of the convention. The states do nothing, Hamilton said, but constantly pursue internal interests adverse to those of the whole. They have their particular debts, their particular plans of finance, etc. Only by lodging a complete sovereignty in the general government, Hamilton said, will the American experiment in republicanism survive. And if that meant that the state governments should be, as he put it, reduced to corporations and with very limited powers, that would be no loss at all in his book. Then he committed the unthinkable. He proposed as a serious alternative to both plans the model of the British monarchy. I believe the British government forms the best model the world ever produced, Hamilton said. After all, Hamilton asked, can there be a good government without a good executive? So, let there be a bicameral legislature, if Randolph insists, but let one branch of the legislature hold their places for life, like the House of Lords. And let the executive also be for life, like the king. Now, Hamilton was aware that the first question anyone would ask was, but is this a republican government? Yes, Hamilton answered confidently. Yes, if all the magistrates are appointed and vacancies are filled by the people or process of election originating with the people. Hamilton then produced a sketch of a plan, which he should prefer to either of those under consideration. And he proceeded to consume the balance of the day's session, laying it all out in detail. If Patterson, Luther Martin, and Gunning Bedford had wanted someone to hand them a stick to beat the Virginia plan with, on the grounds that anything that pointed toward a strong national government was tantamount to monarchy, Hamilton's speech could hardly have been better designed for their purpose. No one spoke in reply to Hamilton. No one offered a second to Hamilton's sketch or offered to send it to a committee. When Madison took the floor the next day to assail the New Jersey plan, he never even referred to Hamilton. Afterwards, William Samuel Johnson of Connecticut grunted that the gentleman from New York, despite being praised by everybody, has been supported by none. 10 days later, Hamilton left the convention for New York. He wouldn't be back till August. Now began nearly 3 weeks of deadlocked misery in the convention. As the partisans of the Virginia plan, Madison, Randolph, and James Wilson, joined by the raffish Gouverneur Morris, traded one fruitless, wearying blow after another with the partisans of the New Jersey plan, Patterson, John Lansing, and Luther Martin. At one point on June 28th, Benjamin Franklin felt desperate enough that he urged the convention to get down on its knees and pray for guidance. How has it happened that we have not hitherto once thought of humbly applying to the Father of Lights to illuminate our understandings? Franklin pleaded. Or do we imagine that we no longer need his assistance? This must have sounded strange, coming from the man who was otherwise known for his fairly scant religious opinions. But, Franklin explained, I have lived a long time, and the longer I live, the more convincing proofs I see of this truth that God governs in the affairs of men. And if a sparrow cannot fall to the ground without his notice, is it probable that an empire can rise without his aid? But even this plea fell short. Several expressed their apprehensions that however proper such a resolution might have been at the beginning of the convention, it would now look like a council of desperation, and lead the public to believe that the embarrassments and dissensions within the convention had suggested this measure. Edmund Randolph not only supported the motion, but recommended that thenceforward prayers be used in the convention every morning. But a motion to adjourn headed off a vote on Franklin's motion. And Franklin sighed heavily. The convention, except three or four persons, thought prayers unnecessary. By June 30th, tempers in the convention had grown so short that James Wilson actually told the small state opposition that they might as well go form their own confederation. It would neither stagger his sentiments nor his duty, he said, if the minority of the people of America refused to coalesce with the majority on just and proper principles. If a separation must take place, it could never happen on better grounds. Gunning Bedford retorted that if the small states really had no choice but the Virginia Plan, they will find some foreign ally of more honor and good faith who will take them by the hand and do them justice. Drearily, the convention voted on July 2nd to take an extended adjournment to attend to the celebrations of the anniversary of independence on the 4th of July. Despite the deadlock, though, the means for resolving the standoff already lay at hand, and in two forms. The first was a seemingly innocuous proposal by Connecticut's Roger Sherman back on June 11th, that the proportion of suffrage in the first branch of a bicameral national legislature should be according to the respective numbers of free inhabitants, and that in the second branch, or Senate, each state should have one vote and no more. Roger Sherman was one of the convention's curiosities, not the least because Sherman would become one of only two members of the convention who signed the Declaration of Independence, the Articles of Confederation, and the Constitution. The other was Robert Morris. He began adult life in New Milford, Connecticut, as a shopkeeper, and never attended college. But he had a strong store of native intelligence, and taught himself enough law by reading to pass the bar examination in 1754, moving up from there to become a judge, a member of the Connecticut legislature, mayor of New Haven, and even treasurer of Yale. John Adams described him as an old Puritan, as honest as an angel, and as firm in the cause of American independence as Mount Atlas. An old Puritan indeed. Sherman even wrote on the theology of infant baptism, on church membership, and on receiving communion. And in New Haven, his minister was no one less than Jonathan Edwards the Younger, son of the great theologian of the Great Awakening. Sherman's portrait, painted by the most famous New England portrait painter of the post-revolutionary years, Ralph Earle, shows a man of awkward build, rough homespun clothing, a jaw fixed like granite, but a pair of intense and brilliantly piercing eyes. The character sketcher, William Pierce, described Sherman at the convention as the oddest-shaped character I ever remember to have met with. He is awkward, unmeaning, and unaccountably strange in his manner. But in his train of thinking, there is something regular, deep, and comprehensive. Yet the oddity of his address, the vulgarisms that accompany his public speaking, and that strange New England cant which runs through his public as his private speaking, make everything that is connected with him grotesque and laughable. And yet, he deserves infinite praise. No man has a better heart or a clearer head. Sherman arrived at the convention on May 30th. And at first, he was adamant that the Virginia plan would mean the creation of a national monstrosity in which a few large states will rule the rest. The objects of the Union, Sherman said in his first speech on June 6th, were few. One, defense against foreign danger. Two, against internal disputes and a resort to force. Three, treaties with foreign nations. Four, regulating foreign commerce and drawing revenue from it. That was it. But he was not fond of speculation, and he did not regard smallness as a virtue. States, he recognized, may indeed be too small, as Rhode Island, and thereby be too subject to faction. Sympathetic as he was in many ways to William Patterson, Sherman understood that the national debt and the want of power somewhere to draw forth the national resources are the great matters that press. And on June 20th, he offered that if the difficulty on the subject of representation cannot be otherwise got over, he would agree to have two branches and a proportional representation in one of them, provided each state had an equal voice in the other. This time, more of the delegates were listening. Hugh Williamson of North Carolina pleaded, "If we do not concede on both sides, our business must soon be at an end." But Madison was unyielding. The history and fate of the several confederacies, modern as well as ancient, proved to Madison's satisfaction that nothing less than a legislature with proportional representation by population would serve American interests. James Wilson, likewise, dug his ditch even deeper. "Can we forget for whom we are forming a government?" he bellowed angrily on June 30th. "Is it for men or for the imaginary beings called states?" "The rule of suffrage," said Wilson, "ought to be on every principle, the same in the second as in the first branch. If the government be not laid on this foundation, it can be neither solid nor lasting. Any other principle will be local, confined, and temporary." But not even Madison and Wilson could persuade the convention that they were not on the brink of breaking up. When they forced a vote for allowing each state one vote in the second branch, the convention split straight down the middle. 5 aye and 5 nay. The two Georgia delegates, Abraham Baldwin and William Houston, themselves split against each other. "We are now at full stop," Roger Sherman warned, and nobody, he supposed, meant that we should break up without doing something. The solution came in the form of a proposal by Charles Cotesworth Pinckney. He had voted against the New Jersey plan, but he conceded that some compromise seemed to be necessary. To that end, he suggested the creation of a grand committee, consisting of a member from each state, which should take the opportunity of the 4th of July adjournment to devise and report some compromise. So, in addition to Sherman's compromise proposal, the convention appointed a committee to consider compromise in general. Madison fought it to the last minute, vehemently protesting that he had rarely seen any other effect than delay from such committees in Congress. But the vote to create the Grand Committee was lopsidedly in favor, 9-2. Still, nobody was celebrating as the convention broke up for the adjournment. Even Washington was exhausted. "Things are now, if possible, in a worse train than ever," he wrote, "and there was little basis on which the hope of a good establishment can be formed. In a word, I almost despair of seeing a favorable issue to the proceedings of our convention, and do therefore repent having had any agency in the business.